Every night this week, after dark, Liberty Memorial is illuminated top to bottom with bright red poppies. It's a breathtaking display. If you stop by in the evening, you'll see cars lined up in a slow procession around the parking lot to get a closer look. And people are getting out of their cars, too, trying to capture the splendor of the scene with selfies. It's all leading up to the 100th anniversary of Armistice Day. November 11th, 1918 was the day of the armistice that ended World War I. It was a conflict that set the stage for the 20th and 21st centuries. It toppled monarchies, sparked revolutions, challenged colonialism. We live the effects of that war every day. Kansas City is home to the nation's monument to World War I. So we're kicking off today's Central Standard on Armistice Day and war monuments with the story of how that happened, how Liberty Memorial ended up here. Let's tag along with KCUR's Suzanne Hogan to find out.
At the top of the Liberty Memorial Tower is one of the best views of Kansas City.
So eye-opening.
Leah Stoner is here with her 5-month-old son, Grayson. They're in town for a wedding from a small town in Alaska. But to Stoner, this place is about so much more than a view.
My husband is in the military, so just to recognize, like, the sacrifices that were made and, like, it was such a big impact on the history of our country and on people.
There was an estimated 40 million military and civilian casualties during what was then known as the Great War from 1914 to 1918. There had never been a conflict like it. And the Liberty Memorial, the iconic tower that sits on top of the National World War I Museum and Memorial in Kansas City, is preserving the memory of that sacrifice. Mike Vietti is the marketing director for the museum.
The number one question by far that we receive is, why is this museum a memorial in Kansas City?
And to answer that question, we have to go back to the early 1900s, to Kansas City, a place in the midst of an economic boom and with a strong civic spirit.
The slogan for the 2 decades I'm talking about, from 1900 to 1900, to the World War I, or the Great War as they knew it, was make Kansas City a good place to live in. Which we would think is, that's long and cumbersome, and it ends in a preposition. But
Bill Worley is a Kansas City historian.
The point being that they really wanted to make this a good place to live.
They were Kansas City's entrepreneurs of the day. A good place to live also meant a good place to make some money. Just look around today at some of the city's street signs and institutions for some clues of who we're talking about here.
J.C. Nichols.
The real estate developer.
The Armour family.
And livestock and meatpacking.
The Kemper family.
The big-time bankers.
William Volker.
A craftsman in the hardware business. And
R.A. Long.
A regional lumber baron. Throw in the mix William Rockhill Nelson, the owner of the Kansas City Times newspaper, and parks guru George Kessler. Regionally, it's a booming time for agriculture, and there's a growing middle class. Horses, electric streetcars, and early automobiles move people all around the city. Steamboats move goods up and down the Missouri River. And of course, there are the rapidly expanding railroads. In the summer of 1914, when Archduke Franz Ferdinand is assassinated and the rest of Europe breaks out into war, Kansas City is gearing up to celebrate the opening of the newly built Union Station. 3 years after that, in 1917, when the U.S. enters the conflict, Union Station becomes a central location for soldiers passing through for training and then overseas. Men enlist, women enter the labor force. Heartland-grown corn and grain is sent to feed troops abroad and then rationed at home.
Johnny, get your gun, get your gun, get your gun. Take it on the run, on the run, on the run. Hear them calling you and me.
On November 11th, 1918, the day of the armistice that ends World War I, Kansas City's in the middle of an influenza epidemic. And despite that, nearly 100,000 people turn out for a victory parade that floods downtown. Historian Bill Worley.
The city was primed to do something big.
Within a couple weeks of the armistice, a lot of those civic leaders who we mentioned earlier meet to organize ways to memorialize those who served, including 441 soldiers from Kansas City who died. They start the Liberty Memorial Association. Here's Mike Vietti from the museum again.
This really was, in many respects, a crowdsourced national museum and memorial.
In 1919, over the course of a 10-day fundraising campaign, 83,000 Kansas Cityans pitch in and collectively raise $2.5 million. Today, that would be worth $35 million. Curator Laura Vogt says even school children pitched in their nickels.
It's a tribute to the Kansas City and Kansas City spirit.
Vogt says creating World War I memorials was a popular thing nationally and internationally at the time. They're all over the place. But what makes Kansas City's unique is the quick community way that it was financed and the scope of it. Positioned across the street from Union Station stands the 217-foot-tall Liberty Tower, with four guardian spirits and a light and steam display at the top that looks like a flame. Two halls are at the tower's base, and at the entrance on either side sit two Assyrian sphinxes. Vogt says the sphinx facing east symbolizes memory. It's shielding its face from the horrors of war. And the sphinx facing the west symbolizes the future.
Even then, the architects and the designers recognize that we don't know what the future holds.
Not long after the Liberty Memorial opens, the Great Depression hits, an economic crisis that impacts the progress of other memorials across the nation. Then, of course, there's World War II, democracy's rise, so does fascism, there are revolutions, genocides.
The entire world was reshaped by what happened in World War I.
Which is why Mike Vietti believes this memorial and museum are so important. The museum had a rough patch in the 90s when it had to close its doors and raise money for long-needed renovations. But in 2004, Congress passed legislation designating it as the National World War I Museum. And then in 2014, Congress designated it as America's official World War I Memorial. Plans for another national World War I Memorial in D.C. are still in the works. Vietti says last year they had 600,000 visitors from all 50 states and 75 different countries. Here you can see what it was like to live in a trench, old artillery equipment, propaganda posters, and poppies. On this particular day, a choral group from Liberty Memorial Central Middle School in Lawrence are performing a recital in the museum lobby. Mike Vietti says he hopes this space will continue to be a place for people to learn the lasting lessons from World War I.
I would hope that during the next 100 years that World War I doesn't become a footnote in the history books.
So that a travesty like the Great War, a conflict meant to be a war to end wars, never happens again.
Suzanne Hogan brought us that story. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And with Armistice Day coming up this Sunday, we're going to talk about the tradition of erecting war monuments. It's sort of an odd thing to make sense of, in a way. Are they tributes to the fallen and their sacrifices, or tributes to the wars themselves? Lots of conflicting emotions to reconcile around all of that, but also, where did this tradition come from and how has it changed over time? Let's start that conversation now with Scott Manning. He's an independent historian based in Philadelphia. He calls himself a historian on the warpath. That's his blog title, and he's written a lot about our relationship with war monuments, both modern and ancient. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Gina.
So what does that mean, historian on the warpath?
Well, it was a moniker I came up with on where I was finding focus at the time when I started my blog. I really enjoyed going to battlefields and trying to retrace steps of battles and events, and also the monuments that were left there by the people who fought them or people who tried to remember them.
What interests you about war monuments?
Wow, a lot. So interestingly is how different they can vary depending from conflict to conflict and people to people over time. But then also some of the ways they are the same, regardless of the people or the language or the period, you can find a lot of commonalities between them. And you could go to a place like Gettysburg or a place like Verdun or even some of the ancient Greek battlefields and find very similar ways of which battles were fought, but also ways in which people tried.
You begin your blog post titled Rethinking War Monuments with a story about two ancient Greek monuments that kind of broke the rules that Greeks had actually established for these kind of things. Can you encapsulate that for us now?
Absolutely. So when you read Herodotus or Thucydides, they talked about kind of the culture of battles that you found in Greek city-states. And these people would get together and they would dress up in their hoplite gear and had a set of ceremonies that they would go through to fight a battle to decide some dispute. And part of that ceremony at the end, when the battle was over, the winning city-state would set up some sort of memorial or monument, and depending on which, you know, who's translating it, you'll see it described that way. But whatever that memorial was, it usually involved taking gear or shields or weapons from the city-state that you happen to defeat and setting it right there on the battlefield, where the heaviest fighting was or things like that. It was very much a temporary structure and something that over time would just disappear or would get looted or you know, get built over. The two monuments mentioned in Herodotus have to do with the Battle of Thermopylae in 480 BC, where the Spartans, you know, famously throughout history, as we know, stood up to the Persians and were ultimately defeated at the Pass of Thermopylae. And Herodotus describes two different monuments. One at the actual battle site was a bronze lion erected specifically to Leonidas, who was one of the Spartan kings that fought and died there. And he talked about this monument in glowing terms. But then he also talked about another monument that existed at Sparta itself that commemorated the battle and listed the names of the Spartans who died there. And specifically, it listed the Spartans who were members of that city and that class there. It did not make mention of the names of the slaves that they brought with them to help them fight against the Persians, but it mentioned specifically the names of the Spartans. And Herodotus bragged that he read over this monument, was able to memorize the 300 names. And because of that, while we don't know all the names, we at least know from Herodotus that there were 300 that fought there because of that monument. So it kind of bucks tradition, but in a way it's because they buck tradition, we actually get some more details about the battle and Herodotus was able to figure out exactly where it happened because of the lion monument at the Thermopylae Pass.
So, okay, first of all, I need to say we are about to change our connection with you a little bit because we have a little bit of a bad connection, and I want to make sure our listeners can hear the really interesting history you're giving us. But so just so everyone knows that that's happening, but I want to draw attention to something you just said that might seem like a minor detail, but it has some real repercussions. These monuments are how we know, not just how we know where historic events that happened in ancient times took place, but it's also how people living back then would have known. People back then would not have had another way of knowing where a battle happened and how it turned out necessarily. This was like communication, journalism done in stone. Sorry, can you repeat that?
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Perfect. Okay. Yeah, you're absolutely right. It was definitely a way to point out where the battles happened. And interestingly enough, not just in the ancient times, we've actually benefited in modern times from helping us locate some of these battlefields because there were monuments there that we found later. One battle in particular that I was able to go out to Greece and see was the battlefield of Leuctra. Now, for those unfamiliar, as I was before I started digging into this a while ago, the Battle of Leuctra was fought between Spartans and Thebans, and at the time, this was Spartan at the height of their power, and they were enslaving city-states around their area, and they showed up to this area in Boeotia, which is north of Athens, and there, a group of city-states led by Thebans from the city of Thebes confronted the Spartans and were able to defeat the Spartans, who at the time were considered militarily the best in fighting. They had defeated Athens. They had fought the Persians over the previous 100 years. And the Thebans were able to defeat them and actually kill a Spartan king. And in doing this, afterwards, they went and erected a monument, but it was not the type of monument that Herodotus and others had described as being a temporary one. They actually built a large stone structure with a bronze statue on it. We found remnants of it back in the 1800s, and because we know that this monument existed and other historians such as Strabo and even Cicero mentioned the existence of this monument, where it was, we were able to connect the dots and actually pinpoint and say, this is where this particular battle happened. But up until the 1800s, because that monument had been lost and because landscapes change, we today in modern times weren't exactly sure where the battle happened. So it's something that, that helps communicate not only to the people right then and there, but also a couple thousand years later, we benefited from it.
So this is obviously not why we make war monuments today. At least I don't believe that it is. But there's like kind of a long journey between then and now with a lot of different moments of change and transition and different cultures responding differently to war altogether. Plus, there's this whole fact that some battles don't require us to build anything to leave a trace. They leave their own monuments. But how would you say, just jumping to early U.S. history, how are the monuments you just described different from and similar to what you see in this country, like from the Revolutionary War or the Civil War?
Well, that's a great question. And today, when you look at some of the monuments that we have to the Revolutionary War, such as the Battle of, when you look at the Revolutionary War to like the Battle of Bunker Hill, anyone in Boston who goes there, there's a giant tower that sits there now, and most of the area is developed over. If you go to a place such as Valley Forge, although there wasn't a battle there, it's a place we remember today, and it's a national park. At the time, after the Revolutionary War, all that land was reclaimed by local farmers, and it wasn't until much later that people started seeing it as a place that we should visit and try to restore or preserve. And much of the area that Washington had set up with trenches and things like that started getting taken over. Today it's blocked off and we rebuilt huts that they would have stayed in to try to remember what that experience was like. But in the Revolutionary War at that period, it just wasn't something that was ingrained in us to try to mark the exact spot where battles happen and preserve them as we do today in America. There's of course some anomalies in that rule, but the concept of saying if a battle happened there, let's mark it and remember it and preserve the battlefield, that is very much a newer concept that's really gained steam over the past 50 to 100 years.
So World War I is an interesting case. It was a global conflict, but it was fought mostly on European soil. So I'm curious, you know, we've got Liberty Memorial built in Kansas City, making sure we Americans never forget what happened. Does Europe have a different tradition that you see in their monuments and memorials?
Yes, absolutely. And if you go to places like Verdun or the Somme, it's a much more somber experience. And that can seem weird to say for those who've actually gone to the Kansas City Memorial, because it's certainly somber. But I think more Americans are probably familiar with Civil War battlefields and World War II monuments and experiences. Those tend to have a little bit more of a commemorative experience, almost celebratory, especially when you look at World War II memorials.
Celebratory of the Allied victory in the case of World
Correct.
War II.
Correct, yeah. Yes, very much so. What you'll see at a place like Verdun are monuments that Americans haven't seen before. You'll see monuments that feature depictions of the Grim Reaper standing over slain soldiers. You know, they would have they may have an animal depicting something like a lion, but the lion will be slain, and it's disturbing, quite frankly. I don't know the way to put it.
It's about the death and the carnage.
It's very much so, very much about what happened there, as opposed to celebrating that, hey, we won.
Okay, I'm going to jump in here because we're off to a break, but more on Liberty Memorial and how it fits into this international and our national conversation about World War I after this break. I'm Gina Kaufman, KCUR Central Standard. We'll be right back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and I've been talking to a Philadelphia-based historian about war monuments, ancient and modern, as part of our conversation about Liberty Memorial here in Kansas City. Now let's bring it back home, Liberty Memorial, and how it fits into the big picture when it comes to monuments to World War I, both internationally and here in the United States. Mark Levitch, good morning.
Good morning, Gina.
You started a World War One memorial inventory project. You're documenting or trying to document all the World War One memorials in the United States. Maybe a silly question, but why hasn't that been done before? That war ended 100 years ago.
That was my question. I think it was, generally considered a local issue. Each community was responsible for its own memorials. And it wasn't until I was in London for a World War One conference and I realized that the UK was undertaking a war memorial inventory in conjunction with the centennial of the armistice that I asked them is this feasible? How does one go about doing this? And the answer was we should have waited to start because when they started, it was pre-internet, and they thought I would have a much easier job of it. And indeed, now that we're able to crowdsource things, I get contributions from all across the country.
So, okay, stepping back a moment, we just heard that there is a different kind of approach in Europe to memorializing really those lost in World War One and just the dramatic losses of life. Images of the Grim Reaper, really somber beyond just the sort of peacefulness and like decorum. You know what I mean?
Is
that what you see as well? What would you say is the real spirit of a U.S. World War One memorial?
Well, there's a lot of diversity. I mean, obviously you have the Liberty Memorial, which is a one-of-a-kind thing. But other communities, for the same reasons, were interested in commemorating the war. And I would say that sort of the stereotypical World War One memorial is a sculpture of a World War One soldier known as a doughboy. And so you have these doughboy memorials across the country. And they are, come from the tradition of the Civil War standing soldier memorial, generally mass-produced, not particularly artful. But whereas the Civil War soldiers, of which there are hundreds, are at parade rest,
what do you mean by that, parade rest?
Parade rest is sort of arms crossed, not a fighting posture, almost an at-ease posture. And whereas the doughboy sculptures, the vast majority, are confidently, overconfidently, exaggeratedly in fighting poses. And there's one in particular that is found, one model of which there are 140 or so copies, where the doughboy is grasping its bayonet in its left hand, its rifle with its bayonet. And in its right hand, right arm is getting ready to throw a grenade. It is charging forward. And his mouth is open as if screaming, like, here I come, charge, that kind of thing. This is very much what World War One warfare was not, right? I mean, this is somebody who would have been wide open, incredibly vulnerable pose. People were not sort of doing this sort of hyper-masculine charging straight ahead in the fighting itself. And so this is sort of a way, this is more triumphant. This is a more focus on an individual soldier, individual heroism in a war that was very much not about that stereotypically. So it's interesting. And that is sort of the mainstay. And that is very different from other countries.
Scott Manning, with us from Philadelphia, how has this practice of commemorating wars and honoring the fallen changed since World War One? Remembering World War Two has really unique challenges.
It does. And I think Mark captured some of the commonalities among World War monuments perfectly. I still think there's a desire to remember those who died in these battles as fighting like he described, picturing them as in a reality way that they could have died, is very disturbing, especially when you consider in some of these wars, especially World War One, a lot of them died from just sickness or wounds. It wasn't in the climax of battle, like are depicted in some of these monuments. But there's still that celebratory nature, I think you'll find in World War II monuments. And it's I think it all comes back to a need.
Monuments created soon after the end of the war anyway.
Correct. And there's a desire, and it's human nature, to look at folks who died in these battles as having died for a reason. It wasn't for nothing. It wasn't a waste. So I think some of these depictions, especially like the one Mark describes, gives you that feeling, that hyper-masculinity. Someone fought and died, and you know, died with their boots on, died almost the way they wanted to. You could word it like that, or at least people could interpret that way. So I think with the World War II monuments, you don't see as many depictions of physical people. You'll see a lot more obelisks. There'll be a lot more artilleries set up.
Would that be partly because the bulk of those deaths were civilian deaths?
You're talking about
World War II.
Yeah, and that's not something we experience here in America so much because it didn't come as close to home as it did for some of these European countries. But we'll want to remember how the soldiers fought and died in those battles, or at least remember how we wanted them to.
So, there is just taking a very different approach to the concept of what it means to have a monument coming out of a war-type experience. There is a monument to World War II in Europe that I just found out about, and I find it really chilling but oddly perfect in a way. And just a warning, this is somewhat gruesome. It is a monument on the banks of a river in Hungary where Jews were lined up, told to remove their shoes, and then shot. And they would fall into the water and die. So now there is a monument there that's just a row of iron shoes. Can you comment on, that is a very different idea of what it is to have a monument coming out of war.
It is, and it's chilling. I mean, and so if we look back on history, and we go back to our earliest monuments, a lot of monuments in human history were built towards remembering the rulers, the emperors, the kings, going all the way back to Egyptians, Assyrians, even getting into the Roman world. A lot of those monuments centered around what the rulers did in battle or in war, and today that's obviously absent. I mean, we may remember generals, or we may try to memorialize doughboys, but what you're describing is trying to get down to the people who are suffering in war the most, those who didn't sign up to fight or weren't even enlisted. They just died. That's something that's remarkable and chilling that we do today, especially building something out of bronze or out of stone that we want to last for a long time.
Well, speaking of that, I want to jump in here. We just have a little bit of time left, but Civil War monuments, of course, are being revisited even like conceptually now. They were built a long time ago. As we start to look at conflicts differently, the more time passes after they're over, what does it mean for these monuments to stay the same forever is a long time?
It is, and so I think the perception you have is what people see out of monuments. You said those monuments were built a long time ago. Some of them were, a lot of them were not. You go to Gettysburg, you can find monuments that are younger than the three of us, for sure. But it feels like it's been there forever, but you look at the date, it's like, oh, this was built in 1985. But it's out of granite and bronze, and it looks permanent. So I think what we need to do, and I think this is what Mark's doing through his website, is not only identifying these monuments, classifying, but also trying to figure out what's the interpretation behind them. Who sure. built them, and why did they build them? What was the purpose? And then even how do we look at them today?
And how do they change? Every monument changes over time. These are not as permanent as they're meant to be when they're erected. Each generation will see it differently. And that's certainly something we're seeing now with Civil War memorials and also with World War One memorials, where the names that are listed And listing names is something that really gained traction again with World War I. But in the South in particular, if African Americans are listed at all, the plaques are segregated. And so people are revisiting that issue.
You know, Mark Levitch, just before we go, how does Liberty Memorial fit into that? I mean, can it teach us anything? I find it fascinating that this is a monument that manages somehow, at least as far as I've observed as a Kansas Cityan, it manages to be fairly unifying no matter how people feel about war. Like, people who are serving in the military and their families, they like it. Pacifists like it. People find it honorable.
Yeah, it strikes the perfect tone, really. I mean, it is somber, as you said. It is a commemoration of something horrible and something that we hope to forestall in the future, and yet it also honors the people who were forced to condemned, you know, to participate in this.
Mark Levitch, Scott Manning, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Armistice Day is this Sunday, November 11th, and this year it marks 100 years since the end of World War I, the war to end all wars, or so they believed at the time. I'm Gina Kaufman, and KCUR's Central Standard continues in a minute. Stay with us. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now I'm joined by Bill James. What just happened? And that pause is probably different depending on your relationship with baseball. If you don't follow baseball, you might not know who Bill James is. But if you do, like at all, you probably freaked out a little. Bill James is a legendary baseball statistician, so much so that he was brought on as a senior consultant for the Red Sox, who perhaps not coincidentally won the World Series this year. He's from Holton, Kansas, originally. He still lives in Kansas, and he's here with me now. Hi, Bill. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thank you for having me on.
So there is a word for what you do, sabermetrics, and you basically invented it, right?
I invented the word. I was first person to try to make a living doing it, so in a sense I invented it.
What's the difference between old school stats and sabermetrics?
There's not really any connection. What we do doesn't really have anything to do with statistics. What we do is pick up a question and try to work with scientific methods or crude imitations of scientific methods toward an answer. And the key to the profession is trying to find a question to which you don't sincerely know the answer.
So can you give me an example of such a question and then how sabermetrics gets you from question to answer?
Well, one argument we've been having for 40 years is whether clutch hitters actually exist. In baseball before the 1970s, it was universally accepted and universally believed that clutch hitting was a major component of a player's value, as his ability to hit in a key situation. Literally nobody who works in baseball anymore still believes that. But the argument is whether there is some smaller occasional thing as a clutch ability. And you pick up that question and study, do these players hit better with runners in scoring position? Do they hit better in the late innings of close games? And of more importance, is it predictable?
So how is the process that you work through different from statistics?
A statistician makes records of things. What the statisticians do is essential to what we do because we need those records. Baseball had statisticians for 100 years, more than 100 years, before I started my career. And this was an enormous asset because when I started, there were 100 years of very, very well-maintained records, meticulous records, outstanding records for 100 years of stuff that nobody had ever studied at all to speak of. I mean, they'd studied it for trivial reasons, but not for trying to gain knowledge. And that was, but statisticians make records of things. People in my field study the records to try to resolve questions that we don't know the answers to.
So you were, as I said, you were brought on by the Red Sox. The idea that statistics or sabermetrics, the idea that someone can study records and study how things play out broadly, the idea that that could help a baseball team win is not totally self-evident? I mean, you might have made it seem that way over the course of your career, and people have now probably accepted that to some extent. But the idea that more than just athletic prowess on some like kind of brawn type level is at play may not be obvious to everyone, at least not to the casual observer. Can you explain how sabermetrics can be used to help a team win?
It's a question of fighting ignorance, basically. There are in baseball and in every other field, banking, flying, anything, there is a wide range of things that everybody knows to be true, but which nobody has ever actually established to be true. Consequently, there's a large amount of we're on the air, so I can't use that word to describe it. There's a large amount of received wisdom which has never been tested. So people walk around acting on false assumptions all the time. All of us do. In every field, we walk around acting on false assumptions all the time. If you're acting on fewer false assumptions and more proven facts or proven theories than the other guy, you do have an advantage.
And also maybe fewer kind of emotional ideas about, you know, like what you like to see happen in the course of a game. Like I would imagine that coaches are susceptible to human kind of fondness for one player over another, for example, that doesn't match necessarily objectively what they should do in a given situation.
In that case, you have to be really careful about the word objective. Coaches, of course, all of us do, people in my field do too, have fondnesses for certain theories or certain types of players. A coach's fondness for a certain type of player may well be grounded in something that's actual, something that's real, but something that's very, very difficult to document, something that's difficult to measure. So you have to be careful that you're distinguishing between that which is difficult to measure and that which is just not true.
Call 816-235-2888 with your questions for Bill James, the founder of Sabermetrics. 816-235-2888. Bill, you were recently quoted in The Onion, and I understand it's a fake quote, even though you are a real person, but you're so quote-unquote quoted on the exact measure of just how much joy you've sucked out of the game of baseball. Does that bother you?
No.
It's like a running gag. You were also on The Simpsons playing yourself, kind of making a similar point.
Right. No, it doesn't. I mean, people who write parodies of you are almost always actually fans. And you can tell the difference between a parody of you by a fan and a parody of you by somebody who actually doesn't like you. I appreciate the shout out.
But I guess the point that brings up is, do you enjoy baseball as in deriving actual joy from the sport?
I'm not a hyperactive emotional person.
I've noticed that.
But I enjoy baseball more than probably almost anything else in the world, and more now than I did years ago. And if you think about it, the people in the world who know the most about opera and the people who love opera the most are probably the same people. It's true of anything that the more you know about it, the more you understand it, the better position you are in to enjoy it. So I constantly move into a better position to enjoy baseball. Also, as you get older, sometimes you move into a worse position to enjoy things like, let's say, swimming or cross-country racing. And baseball becomes your more and more larger and larger in your life.
What are your earliest baseball memories?
I remember one day, we played baseball just in the backyard from the time I was 5 years old, so I couldn't spot one thing. I remember one time having a dispute in a baseball game with my brother, who threw a baseball and hit me above the eye. Sticks out. In terms of professional baseball, the very first thing that I remember is that I was sick. I was out of school, lying on the couch, listening to the radio, and they announced that the American League home run champion, Rocky Colavito, had been traded for the American League batting champion, Harvey Keene. That's actually the very first memory I have of professional baseball.
So getting from that memory, which is sort of the beginning of you becoming this person who would become so obsessed that you actually found a field when it comes to understanding baseball, sabermetrics. Then pivoting forward to the future, what's the next frontier for sabermetrics?
The sabermetrics in the last 12 to 15 years has been buried by new data. We've developed so much new data in terms of measuring how fast the ball is moving and where the ball is moving and where the runner is moving that it will take decades to dig out from under it and make sense of it. So the next generation of people in my field has their work cut out for them just to understand all of the huge mountains of data that we have already generated.
I am on a staff of baseball-obsessed people, and so I have sourced some questions from them, and I'm going to ask some of those now. And it begins, you know, we just talked about the Onion parody and the Simpsons parody, and you said that you can tell the difference between someone who's doing a parody and is a fan versus someone who actually doesn't like you. On that note, I mean, there are people who actually don't like you and who you've been involved in a very high-profile tussle lately about players pay. Can you talk a little bit about that conflict?
Well, I don't know that it's so high profile, but sure, I'll talk about it. A lot of baseball fans now, and a lot of most baseball writers will talk about a player who makes $2 to $3 million a year as being underpaid because he is a value in the marketplace. I think it's just stupid to talk about a million-dollar baseball player being underpaid.
So this has nothing to do with sabermetrics. This is just how you view millions of dollars.
It has to do with releasing your sabermetric grip on the world and looking at it from a broader perspective. It has to do with stepping away from analysis for a second and putting things in a broader perspective. So I was making that argument yesterday on Twitter, and people were. You have to understand, I've always made unpopular arguments. It's what I do. It's what I've always done, and I still do it. So I was choosing the unpopular side of this argument, which is that while it's wonderful that baseball players are well paid, and I don't in any sense begrudge that to them, nonetheless, to complain about the fact that some four-year veteran is only making a paltry $5 million a year is... it's just stupid.
It's been taken in some ways as a failure to value the players. It sounds like that's not where you're coming from.
Marvin Miller, who founded the Modern Players Union, in a sense, was a friend of mine. I wrote the introduction to his autobiography. I worked with Marvin. I totally on that side. I completely agree with that. But you do have to keep things in some sort of realistic perspective relative to the rest of the world.
So, of course, people here have questions about the Royals, and I've been asked to ask you who would be the best candidate to take over for Ned Yost as the Royals manager. Any specific player on the Royals now or in their minor league system that's like one to watch?
I guess we can rule out Frank White for the time being. No, I don't have an answer to that question yet. I'll think about it. I'll say Jason Varitek. Jason Varitek works for the Red Sox. He's a coach for us now, and I think he's well prepared to be a major league manager.
Let's talk to Brian in Leawood. Brian also has a question about the Royals. Hi, Brian.
Hi, Mr. James. I'm really curious as to what conclusions and what lessons you drew from the Royals of the second half of 2014 and 2015. To a fan like myself, it really seemed like you had a group of players and a manager that played at 110% for a year and a half and was really something that, we may never see again. What is your take on how the Royals were able to do what they did and are there lessons to be learned from that? Thank you.
There are lessons to be learned from that, but it's like a 100-year study to try to figure them all out. You're right. Look, the people in my field for years underestimated the Royals. They would say every spring, "This is a fourth place team," and then they weren't a fourth place team. the people in my field were just wrong. And they have to learn, we have to learn from why they were wrong and how they were wrong. Part of what they were missing is that it does matter if you believe in one another. If you have a team of people working together, it matters a lot whether those people believe, and whether it's you're running a radio station or a gas station or a baseball team, it matters a lot whether those people believe in one another and help one another and have confidence in one another. The Royals kept their team together kept the core of the team, Moustakas and Hosmer and Gordon and others, together for several years and let them develop that confidence in one another. And they did achieve more than they would ever have achieved as a group of individuals.
Erica Hunzinger is on staff here. She's a Missouri politics editor, and I don't understand the question I'm about to ask. It comes from her, and so I'm going to need you to explain the question and then answer it. So here's the question.
Go ahead.
Where do you fall on the continuum of opinions with respect to should the National League institute the designated hitter? And again, explain the question, then answer it.
Well, baseball has the same rules in both leagues and has had for 100 years, except that the American League has a designated hitter rule, meaning that someone bats for the pitcher, and the National League does not have a designated hitter rule. I like the designated hitter rule as an American League fan, but I feel no impulse to impose it on the National League. I like seeing the game both ways. I like the richness of the game from, I don't believe in standardizing things for our convenience.
So one way that sports figures into all of our lives is sports as metaphor. People draw conclusions from sports that they apply to all sorts of areas in life. And it seems that you have actually done some study on crime in your research over the course of your career. And so I'm interested in Steve's question. Steve is calling us from Lawrence. Hi, Steve.
Hi, and hello to Mr. James. I read your recent book, The Man from the Train. Wondered if you see that the skills you brought to baseball would have some purpose and effect in criminology or in history more generally, and I'll take my question off the air. Thank you.
Thanks.
One of the consequences of my career is that people greatly overestimate my own intelligence and my ability to generalize what I do. So I'm constantly being asked by people, can you help us do this or that that's out of my field? And the basic answer is that would be more up to you than it is to me. You can't analyze anything without truly understanding it. You have understanding and analysis are linked. So you have to do an awful lot of study of crime, organized study, in order to be able to adapt analysis to the types of analysis we do in baseball to criminology. People have tried, I hope there's some benefit in that, and that you wish there's some benefit in that. But I don't feel that I personally have the skills to contribute a lot in that area, although I'm willing to try when asked.
You know, it seems to me that you understand baseball, but also more than baseball, in a way that is useful to baseball teams. But what does what you have learned about baseball from watching baseball, from studying baseball, what has that taught you about life?
The reason baseball fascinates me is that it is a small universe, small enough that you can sort of understand it. My whole view of the world is it's too complicated to understand. People think they understand politics or they understand international relations. You don't. They're too complicated. They overwhelm the human mind. Baseball is a small enough world that you can sort of understand it.
So baseball's taught you that you can only know so much.
The world has taught me that. I play baseball.
So why do you stay in Kansas when you could clearly live anywhere?
Lawrence is a great place to live. I mean, I love Boston. I go to Boston frequently. I love New York, except for the Yankees. I love San Francisco, where my son lives, and Seattle, where my other son lives. Lawrence is a great place to live. It's convenient. It's comfortable.
Well, Bill James, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bill James is the founder of Sabermetrics, and he's the senior advisor to the Red Sox. You can share the link to this conversation with your friends. It'll be at kcur.org/centralstandard by the end of the day. You can grab yesterday's post-election analysis while you're there, kcur.org/centralstandard tomorrow. It's a food show. We'll be talking about diners. Thanks to KCUR's Coy Duggar, Suzanne Hogan, Sylvia Maria Gross, and intern Sophia Gillespie for their work on today's show. I'm Gina Kaufman.